It's the Wiggin Sessions, a show where key thinkers and industry pioneers discuss politics, economics, philosophy, and history. Big ideas impacting the economy, the financial markets, and our lives. Here's your host, Addison Wiggin.
Hello, welcome to the Wiggin Sessions, episode 17. I'm your host, Addison Wiggin. Recently, I interviewed my good friend, Jim Rickards, the editor of Strategic Intelligence, Crash Speculator, and Gold Speculator. In this session, we dig into the World Economic Forum, the Davos gang of elites, the Great Reset of the global economy, debt, inflation, and destruction of the dollar. How do individual investors deal with the Great Reset? Ready? Let's jam. Welcome to the Wiggin Sessions, surviving and thriving during the pandemic. The pandemic persists, and actually the economic impacts of the pandemic are going to persist longer than we expect. With that in mind, we have Jim Rickards, whom doesn't really need an introduction because he's a good friend of ours. And also we've talked about what the financial impacts of the pandemic are going to be. Jim's the author of many books. I could list them all off. New Case for Gold, Death of Money, Currency Wars, The Road to Ruin, Aftermath, and then the latest, The New Great Depression, which covers that topic, which is how are we going to actually emerge from the pandemic? So, Jim, welcome. I have a very specific set of questions for you today, but I want to welcome you first and ask, how are you doing? And are you in Portsmouth?
Thanks, Addison. Great to be on your show. Yeah, I'm in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. You know, our motto here is live free or die. I know you have some roots up this way as well. And It's great to be here. It's a beautiful day.
That's good. I think it's probably warmer here, but it's headed your way.
Yeah, the seasons come, so, you know, south to north. I lived in Baltimore for many years. We enjoyed the spring in April and early May. It doesn't quite get here till June, but that's okay. It's coming.
Yeah, and the humidity too.
Yeah.
We're starting to feel it here, which I'm not a big fan of.
Right.
Well, let's get started. I have a very kind of like specific idea that I've been working on for 6 weeks now, is that these sort of big public issues take over politics, and then politics takes over the financial management of the dollar specifically, and then the impact it's very specific on people's own wallets, their own family management, right? So we have these big ideas that suddenly become really urgent and impact your individual life. So like we talked about climate change a couple of weeks ago, and then we were talking about the actual opening of the economy with the vaccines taking effect. And one of the things I want to talk to you about is the Great Reset and taxation. Because those are, to me, they go hand in hand. There is an argument right now that the introduction of the bill for infrastructure the definition of infrastructure needs to be broadened to include climate change. It needs to include social justice. Like, there's a lot of big, big ideas that are going on at the same time. And those discussions are happening with the Davos set, is what we say, right?
Right.
People, the elites who are re-engineering the financial system. And you have a much better view on that than I do. So maybe the best thing to do is just get started with a definition of what the Great Reset is.
Well, easier said than done. I'd be glad to jump in. But, you know, it's funny, us, and that's one of those phrases, the Great Reset or the Big Reset or, you know, however you want to call it, that has two completely opposite meaning. So you ask a great question, I'll answer it. But right off the bat, we're presenting one of the biggest problems, which is propaganda and how you define terms. And of course, George Orwell had a lot to say about this. When you want to, you know, take over debate, you just make up your own definitions. And then everyone's like, oh, Is that what it means? And then you're all of a sudden they're talking your language because you're controlling the definitions. But so for years prior to fairly recently, when people said the Great Reset or the Big Reset, what came to mind and what people talked about, and I was one of them, was something like a new Bretton Woods. We were going to reset the international monetary system, whether that would be this world money, these special drawing rights that are world money issued by the IMF, or whether the dollar would be pushed aside as reserve currency, whether gold would come into play, whether there would be a collapse, or maybe that was the Great Reset. Now, and it had a lot to do with criticism of money printing by the Fed and loose monetary policy and destroying confidence in the dollar, and gold could possibly replace it, et cetera. Now, all of a sudden, you've got Klaus Schwab, who's Mr. Davos. He invented Davos. He's the head of the World Economic Forum. He's the founder of it, going all the way back to the 1970s. Fairly prolific author, and he has a new book that's called The Great Reset, but he puts it in the context of COVID, and I'll come back to that. But what he means, he's using that phrase for a return to globalization, the globalization agenda. So the globalization started in the 90s as kind of an idea. It became more of a reality from a business and supply chain perspective in the 2000s with the rise of China. So all of a sudden, you know, Japanese just-in-time inventory, Chinese Lego-style manufacturing, U.S. consumer demand, global banks, et cetera. This whole global finance supply chain was put into place. It did lower costs. It had a lot of damage, a lot of uncounted costs, but there were some benefits to consumers and an enormous benefit to China. That was globalization. Along comes our friend Donald Trump, and he blows it up. He quits the Paris Climate Accord. He quits the Trans-Pacific Partnership. He puts on tariffs, which is like, you know, the worst thing you could do, according to mainstream economists. He tries to shut the border with Mexico. You know, America first was his motto, you know, et cetera. And he said, I don't want multilateral agreements. I want bilateral agreements. Like, I'll negotiate with a country, but don't throw me in a basket with 10 countries and say, we're going to have this big kumbaya treaty. I'm not doing that. I'll talk to Korea. I'll talk to Mexico, et cetera, as the case may be. So Donald Trump basically threw globalization off the rails. Just in time, because it was, you know, we're pretty far along the path of destroying it. Sorry, go ahead.
No, that was part of a trend too, right? Because Brexit happened during that, and then there's issues with Hungary, for example. Like, there was a lot of sentiment that we ought to be pursuing national interests, and Trump was like the very few things that he was articulate on. Yeah. That was one of them. That we should be articulating a belief that the national borders mean something, and that gives us a starting point for negotiation with other countries. And that's how we work things out.
Well, that's been true since the Treaty of Westphalia in like 1638. Yeah. But the point is, you know, the old saying, since more than a saying is true, if you're in a poker game and you don't know who the sucker is, you're the sucker. Meaning everyone else is ganged up and you just don't know it. The same was true. As the U.S. was doing this globalization thing, China never lost sight of their national interests. Germany never lost sight of their national interests, nor did Japan, nor did any of these other countries. They might have shown up at the meetings and joined the G20 and said all the right things and, you know, give John Kerry a nice conference hall, whatever, for whatever thing he was talking about at the time. Everybody went through the motions, but everybody did so in such a way that benefited themselves. The only country that didn't benefit was the United States. We lost the jobs. We lost the manufacturing. We lost the expertise. We lost the reserves, et cetera. But we're like, hey, globalization is great because I can go to Walmart and buy something for, you know, 10% of what it used to be, except when you got it home, if it was made in China, it broke before you could put it together because the Chinese were making money by selling garbage. So yeah, globalization was a buzzword in the 90s, a reality in the 2000s, but the United States seems to be the only major country that actually kind of thought it made sense. Everyone else played along, and Trump just blew up the myth. He said, no, we're, you know, hey, and he said to other countries, he said, if you're Germany, I don't blame Germany for running a huge trade surplus. I do the same thing. I don't blame the UK for pulling out of Europe. I do the same thing. But we, the United States, are going to do what's in our best interest, as does everybody else. But everyone else was free riding on the United States. Europe, NATO did not put up the money for the defense budgets. They agreed. China never, allowed the currency to strengthen as it might have. Japan never opened their markets beyond a very insignificant degree, et cetera. So Trump blew it up. Now, what Schwab is saying, what Klaus Schwab and the Davos crowd is saying, hey, we're back. We got run off the rails. We need the United States to be a sucker. We need the United States to go along with this, even though maybe some of us don't believe it, because they got the money. They got the dollars. And so if they're willing to subsidize NATO, subsidize Chinese manufacturing, subsidize climate change. Let's just look at climate change. I know this is not a climate change episode, but just for a second, U.S. CO2 emissions, by the way, I happen to think CO2 is, it's kind of almost irrelevant trace gas. I don't buy the whole climate change theory. But that said, U.S. CO2 emissions have plunged in the last 5 years, down more than the individual mandate. We quit the Paris Accord, but if we had stayed in it, we would have outperformed whatever the Paris Accords were asking us to do. Who are the CO2 emitters? China. China's still going up. China gets almost 50% of their energy from coal burning plants, and they're not that clean. So if you want to talk about CO2 emissions, look at China. Don't look at the United States. Having said that, we're the ones who are supposed to do more. We're the ones who are supposed to, shut down fracking, shut down oil, shut down natural gas, shut down the Keystone Pipeline, subsidize electric vehicles, on and on and on. So that's costly to the United States. Higher energy prices hurts our consumers, hurts our jobs, hurts our industries. But somehow we're supposed to do all that for the good of the world, but the world's not doing their share. Well, that's a pretty good deal. If you're the rest of the world, you love globalization because it means you're free riding on Uncle Sam.
Yeah. And so how does that, you said that it's Klaus Schwab is like reasserting that theory or like the inertia of globalization.
Right.
So how does that actually work though? I mean, what happens is they get together and they come up with plans, and Trump wouldn't go along with it.
Right.
For the most part. And then what happens now? Because especially I think post pandemic, there's just sort of a chaotic view of how the world is organized.
And right.
If they're reasserting themselves, they need a lapdog like Biden. Is that it?
Well, I think a lapdog has better response functions than Biden. Biden, I don't blame Biden for anything. He's kind of an empty shell. It's sad. I think it's an embarrassment. I think it's too bad this family lets him be put in this position, but he's sort of non-compos mentis. He signs anything they put in front of him. If you want to understand the so-called Biden administration, you have to say who's really pulling the strings. And we know who it is. I mean, you've got Ron Klain, chief of staff. He's not too ideological. But he's the gatekeeper. Susan Rice is highly ideological, not that bright, but very ideological, very powerfully placed. She's the pipeline from Obama and Valerie Jarrett over at the Shadow White House up in Kalorama. And then Jake Sullivan and Tony Blinken on foreign policy. They're pulling the strings. Biden's kind of a cipher at this point. But yeah, but the opportunity is there. That's absolutely right. A couple of things. Number one, the globalization crowd never went away. They were marginalized by Trump. But now that Trump's gone, they're back. But they never really went away, number one. Number two, when you say they do this, they do that, it kind of comes off like a conspiracy theory. It's not. We know who they are. This is not a mystery. It's Christine Lagarde.
And I say that all the time, actually. That conversation happens in our office a lot. And yeah. I say, well, it's not like it's a secret or something.
No.
This is their plan.
I can tell you who they are. Christine Lagarde had the ECB, Mark Carney, who's now the head of, he's got a new gig. Well, Mark Carney is the only one I know who's the head of two central banks. Maybe Stan Fisher was vice chairman of the Fed and head of the Central Bank of Israel. But Mark Carney was governor of the Bank of Canada and governor of the Bank of England. So he has two central banks. Then he was chairman of the BIS, Bank for International Settlements, which is the central banker's central bank. And now he's the head of something called GFONS, which is it's the Glasgow Financial Alternative for net zero meaning net zero carbon emissions. association, maybe. So Glasgow Financial Agreement on Net Zero, G funds, which is, by the way, that's the lever to basically get the climate change agenda pushed through using the banks as a weapon. So they're going to go to the banks one by one. They already are, and say, hey, if you lend to Exxon or Chevron or, you know, coal miner, forget it, we're going to basically penalize you from a regulatory perspective, which they can do. But if you lend to Tesla and solar panel manufacturers, et cetera, then you get a gold star. So they're going to use the financial system, the financial banks and intermediaries, to dictate who gets loans, who doesn't. They're doing it through Moody's. Moody's is already warning, hey, we might downgrade your credit if you're pumping oil or whatever, regardless of your financial soundness. So they're using all the levers they have, mostly through the financial system and central banking, to implement the agenda. But the point is, so Mark Carney's on the list, Christine Lagarde, Janet Yellen, full-fledged member, you know, Antonio Carstens, who is the head of the BIS today, people at the IMF. We know the names, and they get together at dinner parties at Davos, and they meet elsewhere at the IMF annual meeting and the spring meeting. The whole thing is out there, but these are not household names. Everyone can name Joe Biden. Most people are Boris Johnson's the prime minister of the UK, but how many people know who Mark Carney is? Not very many, but they're extremely powerful. And they have, I said they want a free ride on the United States, which they do. They want the United States to pay for all this stuff. But there's more to it than that. It's not just getting U.S. resources to implement the plan. You have to say, well, what is the plan? What are they trying to do? Right. And it's basically world governance and world control. Okay. So, but once you say that, it's a big agenda, but everything else falls into place. Well, if you're going to have world governance, you better erase borders. You better get rid of national borders. And if you want world solutions, you need a world problem. So, for example, a lot of things are not global issues. They're national issues. So do you think you should subsidize family medical leave or childcare, et cetera? Well, you can debate it. There are two sides to the debate. But that can go country by country, and each country can have a different solution, and they do. But something like climate change, which, you know, climate change is real, but it's not caused by CO2 and it's not caused by human emissions, and you can't control it. But climate change as an issue doesn't respect borders. No one thinks that climate stops at the Canadian border or stops at the Mexican border. So it's perfect for the global agenda. If you're trying to push global solutions, you need a global problem. And what better global problem than climate change? Because there are no borders. But what's the real agenda? We'll get rid of borders, open immigration, flood the United States with illegal immigrants who will then, you know, basically vote Democratic for the rest of their lives, flood Europe with immigrants from the Middle East who will, you know, basically change the character of Europe from historically Western Christian culture to something unrecognizable, you know, et cetera, and global taxation. So right now, I mean, people ask me to describe my career, and I always end by saying I can't tell if I am eclectic or just didn't know what I wanted to be when I grew up, because I've done a number of things. But for 10 years, I was international tax counsel to the world's largest bank. I was. And so the only time we ever got reprimanded by our CEO was when we produced a tax return. This was Citibank in the 70s and 80s. I used to say back when it was a bank before they turned it into a hedge fund. But the only time we ever were ever reprimanded by our CEO is when we produced a tax return that paid zero tax. He said, no. He said, that just looks bad. Can't you guys pay 3% or 2%? Just a little something just to, you know, keep Washington happy. We can't pay zero. It was actually much harder to pay something than it was to pay nothing, because paying nothing was easy. You just lease a couple more 747s, and we own the Alaska pipeline. But it was all these sale-leaseback deals. But if you want to pay like just 2 or 3%, you change one thing that makes your taxable income go up, but then that changes something else over here. We had a cap on election, and that changed. So now you're into the complexity and all the machinery. It was really hard to pay 2%. But my point is, it was child's play to pay nothing. And that's the way corporations look at it. But how do you do that? You go to the Cayman Islands, you go to the Netherlands tax treaty, you go to Ireland, where I think it's about 12%. if you want to pay a little something. And you take your most valuable property and you dump it in a tax haven, and then you license it out to all of your subs and affiliates around the world. But the royalties come back into the tax haven and it doesn't pay any tax. So this has been going on, you know, forever. So the G7, and to some extent the G20, these groups of large countries operating through the OECD, Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, based in Paris. Again, we know who these people are. They're not. It's not a mystery. They've worked out a global tax plan. They have something called, they always have these, they make up words so you don't can't understand what they're talking about. But there's something called BEPS, B-E-P-S, BEPS. Yeah. but that's a base erosion and profit shifting. Base erosion, profit shifting, BEPS. Base erosion means if I'm in the United States, I erode my tax base. I eliminate my tax base with deductions and credits so I don't pay any tax. Profit shifting means I send the royalties over to Ireland where the beer's good and it's 12%. So how do you deal with that? Well, one way to deal with it is for all the major countries to enter into a treaty saying we're going to tax everybody no matter where you are.
And yeah. If you're Yellen just made that proposal to Congress that be a global minimum corporate tax.
Right. But she's just a pawn in a big chess game. I mean, they've been working on this for years. I wrote about this in chapter two of my book, The Road to Ruin, from 2016. So that book's already 5 years old. And the stuff had been around before then when I wrote about it. So this stuff has been around for 10 years or more. Again, I wrote a book about it 5 years ago. But the point being, they're very patient. It's called the salami slice approach. Take a slice, take a slice, take a slice, take a slice. And it might take you years or decades to get the whole salami, but you'll get there as long as you don't give it back. And so, and that was Trump. That was the greatest threat from Trump. It's not that he disagreed with them. It's that he was actually giving liberty back to the people. He was jeopardizing the whole project.
So yeah, that's part of my question for that even kicked off this conversation is for an individual investor, somebody like me, what's important about that? We can recognize the characters and the motives and all that kind of stuff, but right. what do we do about it? And I'll use an analogy right here. There was an article in Wired magazine that was critical of what we call the new oligarchy, right?
Yeah.
The tech titans. And it said, what do their policies for private management of their own networks, what does that do to the American concept of free speech? Like, of the things that we have historically believed in our country, we might recognize the actors and the people that are involved and the things that they're saying in globalization. But as an individual, what other than understanding what's happening, what can you do about it? They control the banks.
Well, there's a lot you can do. For example, with Twitter and Facebook and Google and you know, Instagram and all the different social media platforms, you know, during the campaign, during the presidential campaign in 2020, what they did was beyond belief. Even if you said, Jim, give me your worst forecast, how bad can these people be? I wouldn't have gone that bad.
Give me your worst forecast.
Yeah, well, the New York Post. Okay, the New York Post is the oldest newspaper in the United States of America. It was founded by Alexander Hamilton in the 18th century. Okay, that's what the New York Post is. They got Hunter Biden's laptop, and they got to the guy who had it, physically had it, and he signed affidavits, he gave interviews, he had documentary evidence. It wasn't guesswork, it wasn't hacking, it wasn't anything of the kind. They got it, and they ran a series of stories on it, and Twitter banned the New York Post from Twitter. So, wait a second. Oldest newspaper in America, founded by Alexander Hamilton, highly reputable, smoking gun evidence, not hacking, not guesswork, and you won't run it because why? Well, the answer was they hated Trump and they didn't want to do anything that could hurt Biden. And now this is one of many examples, maybe the most egregious. So here's the defense. Twitter and it's Jack Dorsey, I mean, the guy looks stoned half the time and he's, you know, testifying before Congress. But the point is, they say, well, you violated our standards. It's all BS. I mean, they reinstated the New York Post after the election. Oh, wasn't that convenient, you know? So they'll have Iranian terrorists who are, you know, hanging people from cranes, but somehow that's okay. They get to broadcast on Twitter. So the argument is, the legal argument is, a lot of people don't understand, the First Amendment only applies to government constraints. So the government can't censor you and they can't censor me. And that's what the First Amendment is. But it doesn't really speak to the private sector. If the private sector wants to block somebody, they can. Then I can write an op-ed, but the New York Times doesn't have to publish it. That's up to them. So that's Twitter's excuse. But here's the distinction. For example, if somebody call, if a mafia guy wants to put a hit on somebody and they call a hitman and that goes to an AT&T line, is AT&T responsible for that murder contract? The answer is no. They're what's called a common carrier. AT&T is not in the business of deciding what people can say on the phone. If the government wants to get a warrant, a wiretap, that's fine. If it comes up in evidence at a trial, that's fine. But AT&T is not in the business of filtering what people say on the phone. They can't. They're a common carrier. Same way Greyhound Bus is a private bus company, but they can't kick you off the bus. And they used to kick Black people off the bus. That's clearly illegal. Absolutely. Now, the New York Times can kick you off. They don't have to publish Alison Wigan or Jim Rickards or anybody else. But here's the thing. They're liable. You know, if they engage in defamatory conduct, if they lie, they can be sued. So it's one or the other. If you're a common carrier, you're not responsible for the content, but you have to let everything go, but you're otherwise exempt. If you're a publisher, you are responsible for content. You can pick and choose. You can censor them, but you're liable to be sued. So it's one or the other. You can be the AT&T or you can be the New York Times. Twitter and Facebook and the others, they have it both ways. They get the protection of common carriers. You cannot sue them, but they can pick and choose who they run, and you can't sue them either. So they're exempt from recourse. They're exempt from being sued for wrongful censorship, business interference, et cetera, but at the same time, because they claim exemption is in effect a common carrier. So they have the common carrier exemption, but the discretion to censor. Nobody else has that.
Yeah. I wonder how, because I haven't done any of that research, but how did it get to the point where AT&T was exempt from the calls that were being made?
That's always been true. It's been true from the start.
Why does that law just automatically apply to say, Facebook?
Well, it would have, except for Section 230 of one of the Communications Acts. And that's the point. They bought Washington. They bribed Washington, in effect, and they got this exemption I'm talking about. So they have all the attributes of a publisher, meaning they can kick you off and they can censor you and they can block you, but none of the liabilities that come with that.
So Section 230 of, do you know which bill?
Well, it's a law. I'd have to look at it. I think it's, there's, I don't have the exact, it's the Telecommunications Act, but it's fairly recent, somewhere in the 2000s. It's easy to look up, but that Section 230, which they lobbied for, they paid for, gives them the freedom to censor, but cannot be sued. That's where they are. Now, it's time to change that, but the members of Congress are all on the payroll. I mean, Google's got it. I think the
Google. Well, that's what I think is interesting too is, and I've been having this debate, is like we could recognize that the Great Reset is globalization, and we could argue with that. But if we do argue with it, then we could be deplatformed because we don't go along with the agenda, which so far, I mean, we're a private company too. And I was literally just writing about this yesterday. Like, so far, we are able to say what we think because we're still a private company, and the relationship that we have with readers is a contractual one.
Right.
And we can continue to do that. But it feels like to me, and I understand the ownership aspect of having the network be private, because I value that. But if we're saying that people can't say stuff, I don't know. There's a gray line there that hasn't been figured out, in my opinion.
Well, it has been figured out, and it's been completely manipulated by Silicon Valley and social media by buying up the Congress. So now we know what the problem is. We just talked about it. We know what the solution is, which is to repeal Section 230. But is that going to happen? I don't think so. I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon. Now, the other thing they said, the other solution was, well, you know, Twitter said, just go start your own media company. You know, we did. Why don't you? Yeah. Well, people did that. People started an
alternative.
It was called Parler. And it's like, oh, yeah, but if you want 100 million or a billion users on your social media platform, you better have a server processor farm the size of a small state. And they do. They're out in near Moses Lake, Washington. That's where Amazon Web Services is. It's a lot of cheap energy from the Columbia Valley, lots of sunshine. But the problem is somebody owns that server farm. Somebody owns those routers and processors. And guess who owns them? Amazon. So Parler comes along. They look like a viable competitor for Twitter. Conservatives are moving over en masse. They're like, I'm done with Twitter. Get me on Parler. We'll have our own conversation over here. And Amazon deplatforms them. And Apple kicks off their app from the App Store. And Parler goes to zero overnight. I mean, it's still there. It came back. And that's backed by, in part, by Rebecca Mercer, Robert Mercer's daughter. But they were big Trump supporters. But the point being, even when you start your own company, you take that financial risk. You're the entrepreneur. You do all the hard work. You build the business. You get the following. They still deplatform you. So now what do you? So now you got to get into the server business. You got to build your own server. It can be done, and it is being done, but it takes years. And we're seeing that in pockets, but it's another problem. I think if you said, you know, I'm very active on Twitter, maybe I'll get deplatformed after this interview. But the point is, by the way, the impact, Addison.
Well, that would be awful if you did.
You know, I gave the New York Post as an example. You know, the New York Post is a big boy. They've been around. They're still publishing. They're still out there. The whole thing with Twitter is probably going to come back to haunt them at Twitter sooner than later. But the New York Post is out there. But the impact is not so much on one publication like the New York Post, where they run you off the road to hurt Trump. Okay, that's bad enough. It's all the people who live in fear. It's all the everyday people who might have an opinion or a view or an original contribution or smaller publications, people who can't afford to be deplatformed because they're
or people who have a vote.
But it's not just running the New York Times off of Twitter. People are getting fired. People are losing their jobs. Assistant professors are not getting tenured. Researchers are not getting research grants. You know, executives are being fired because they said the wrong thing. So what happens is that it's the impact on all the tens of millions of people who are afraid to speak up. That's much more damaging than picking a fight with the New York Post. The New York Post will still be here tomorrow. But all those little voices, when I say little, they're not big platforms, but they are voices. That's where originality, entrepreneurship, creativity come from. That's how opinions shift. That's how democracies are governed. And if you frighten all those people, scare them into a corner, that's an enormous loss. But that's what they're doing.
I'm still troubled by the motive.
Well, that's a big one. So we talked about the people. We know who they are. And by the way, I've actually met a lot of these people. I don't know that that's kind of weird, but given the fact I'm a pretty severe critic, but you know, I gave a private briefing to the head of the Bilderberg Group. That's about as spooky a group as you can imagine. We did in Rockefeller Center, of all places. I thought that was appropriate. But I've actually met, you know, quite a few of these people, central bank governors and Bernanke and others, and spent time with them, Tim Geithner, et cetera. So I have a little insight. I don't know how I get invited. People keep telling me I won't get invited back, but somehow I do. So I have a lot of insight into some of the behavior and background and motives, et cetera. So we talked about who they are. We talked about what they're doing, but you put your finger on the big question, why are they doing it? And I think here there are a couple different threads. People like Janet Yellen, I don't think she's Lex Luthor. I don't think she's an evil genius. I think she's just a nerdy, high IQ, but not very wide bandwidth central banker who doesn't understand central banking. And now she's Secretary of the Treasury. And she goes along with this stuff. And like I say, she just goes along. But some people are much more ill-intentioned. They have this world power agenda. Like, who doesn't want to run the world? Like, actually, I don't. I'm kind of busy. But a lot of people do want to run the world, do want to tell people what to do. There's a gene. It's like some people have it, others don't. I don't, but there are people who, like, they just can't get through the day without bossing other people around. Well, just take that to the nth degree and you've got the, you know, the Davos agenda. But why? You know, is it atheism? You know, if you check these people out, a lot of them are atheists. Is it Greed, yeah, that's a factor. You can, if these people make a lot of money, you can make a lot of money if you get with the program. You know, it's like they just salt you. I mean, so I'm an author. I have a great relationship with my publisher and in my newsletters. Barack Obama and Michelle Obama got a $60 million advance on a 4-book deal. That's unheard of. You can't sell enough books to make $60 million, but they did. But that's almost like legalized bribery. It's not actual bribery because they signed a book contract. And I guess they had a couple of books and the books are bestsellers, but not $60 million worth. But that's just a way of putting $60 million in their pockets. Like, you know, and then you get these Netflix deals. What do Barack and Michelle Obama know about video production, streaming, original features? Nothing. The answer is nothing. But they got at least 8, maybe 9-figure deal from Netflix for, you know, a series of whatever. I'm still waiting to see. Al Gore started a cable channel called Oxygen. He was an early investor. He was given a big stock grant and as a contributor. And it wasn't very successful, but it was bought out by a Middle Eastern sovereign wealth fund for close to $1 billion. And he gets his multi-$100 million payday. So they have ways of enriching these people that are non-commercial, non-economic, but that's okay. The economics is not the intention. The intention is to make them very rich, keep them loyal to the agenda, make sure they stay on board. So now you've bought up Barack and Michelle and Gore and Yellen. And, you know, she was making, I think, $800,000 a speech. I'm also a public speaker. I do okay, but I don't make $800,000 a speech. But she does. And she doesn't say anything in these speeches that she doesn't say, you know, on the TV interview. I don't know what you're getting for your $800,000. But what you are doing is you're ingratiating yourself and making her very rich. And, you know, I don't have to pick on individuals because it's a long list. But the point is the network is self-reinforcing, self-enriching. So greed is a factor. So sort of atheism, greed, lust for power. But is there, you know, Bill Gates seems to be into depopulation, you know, coming up with ways to kill people in effect. I mean, you know, indirectly, there's a lot at stake here. And these are the people who are not just in it for a little more money or a little more notoriety. They really want to reshape the world and they're pretty, you know, borderline evil. And they have to be stopped, but how you stop them, that's a different story.
Yeah. Are you fearful, given that outlook, that sort of rugged individualism or entrepreneurship as we know it can exist post-pandemic? Because it feels like they're using the pandemic, they, and I hate using that phrase because it's, I don't think it's a,
we name names, so you can put Fauci on the list.
Yeah, it's like,
do you know Fauci?
Fauci
owns patents that are inputs to the Moderna vaccine.
Yeah, which is just annoying.
Well, it's not annoying. It's a total conflict of interest. It's dishonest. Yeah. That's why he's dishonest.
But my question though is like, are you fearful that the free society that we believe in and you and I love and innovation and entrepreneurship can exist moving forward? Sometimes I wake up in the middle of the night and I'm like, oh shit, like what are we doing to ourselves?
Yeah.
And I feel like by complying with a lot of things, we're just feeding the beast. And it's important to me to understand what the motives are, because there has to be an argument against it, because I just don't believe in what they're doing.
My partial solution is non-compliance. You tell me what to do, there's a good chance I'll do the opposite. But I encourage people to do that. Yeah, this COVID thing it's the third worst pandemic in the last 650 years. But the COVID pandemic was a gift to the globalists and the power elite that we just discussed. Mm-hmm. Because the easiest way, you can give orders all you want, but the easiest way to get people to go along, to follow orders, is fear. And this was used to instill fear. Now, once they realized that, once that came together over the course of 2020, they said, hey, we got to keep this thing going. You know, we got to,
you can see that day by day.
We got to keep the fear out there because it's working for us. And by the way, I'm not a libertarian and I'm not an Austrian economist. I study Austrian economics. I think it has something to offer. But I know people, I won't mention names, there's no need, but kind of go to, George Mason University at a very high graduate level. George Mason is known, it's a fine school, but it's known as kind of a libertarian Austrian center, work for, say, Reason Magazine and, read Ayn Rand and check all the boxes, right? You're like, okay, you are the greatest libertarian. You stand up to government. You don't let them boss you around. So the minute COVID came along, they just snapped to attention, wearing their masks in a car by themselves. You're staying home, not going out. I mean, I did the opposite. I started planning field trips. Like if it was hard to fly, I'd say, okay, talk to my wife and says, let's go to Pittsburgh, visit the Andy Warhol Museum because I want to see some Andy Warhol art. And we did, and we had fun. You know, the hotels were empty, the streets were empty, but we just said, let's get out. You can't live in fear. I use a bandana style mask and I never wear it unless I have to. So if I go into your store, it's a private store, Trader Joe's now. If they require a mask, I put the mask on. I'm not going to sit there and fight with the greeter at Trader Joe's about a mask. I have a choice also, which is I don't have to go in, right? But on the street, in my car, anywhere else I can think of, in a park, I don't wear a mask, period. And I've seen people shy away from me, cross the street. Here comes a guy without a mask. And I'm encouraging people to tear up their masks, throw away their masks, declare independence, visit your family, get involved in social gatherings. Let's get our lives back. Stop living in fear. But that's me, easier said than done. People are living in fear. And when they live in fear, they're easier to boss around. So why would you want to stop the fear? You have to keep it going.
Yeah. And you can raise taxes that way.
Oh, yeah. Because it's like the first thing you said, Addison, is the push in this infrastructure bill. Well, somehow childcare, government subsidized childcare and paid family leave are infrastructure. They're in the infrastructure bill. You can look it up. Well, why is that infrastructure? Well, if you ask Jen Psaki in the White House briefing room, she goes, well, it's human infrastructure. Oh, really? I thought infrastructure meant bridges, tunnels, roads, and airports. Like, now it means childcare.
Yeah. Well, but that's what they've been saying. That literally has been what they're saying is we have to broaden the definition of infrastructure. But what they're saying is any concern that anyone has, the government can solve it. And we're going to tax you in order to pay for the agenda that we have created.
Well, yeah, but okay. So they do polls. They said Americans support infrastructure. Well, Americans do support infrastructure. If you mean bridges, tunnels, airports and roads, they do. But do they support paid family medical leave? Well, some do, some don't. It's a legitimate policy issue. I'm not being categorical about whether you should do that or not, but don't call it infrastructure. But they do call it infrastructure because they know infrastructure is popular. So how do you get a $2 trillion bill? By the way, Addison, I disagree with one thing you said. So they're raising taxes to pay for it. They are raising taxes. You're quite right about that. But if you study modern monetary theory, which is the law of the land, I mean, that's what everyone in Washington's doing. How else do you explain $7 trillion of deficit spending in the last 2 years? It took us 230 years. To get to $22 trillion in debt, and we've added $7 trillion in 2 years. Debt went up 33% in 2 years after 230 years to get where we were. But modern monetary theory says you don't need a tax system because people say, well, because it used to be in Washington, somebody said, well, I want to do this. I want free college tuition, forgive student loans, to pay childcare, pay pre-K, et cetera. And the answer, you could shut down the debate and go, well, fine, but we can't afford it. We got budget rules, et cetera. Well, now when you say we can't afford it, they say, yes, we can, because all you have to do is print the money. In fact, Stephanie Kelton, who's the leading, the bright light of modern monetary theory, such as it is, says, we don't even need a bond market. Everyone's like, well, you got to borrow the money. You got to issue bonds. What if they don't buy the bonds? She said, we don't need a bond market. The bond market is a favor. We're doing a favor to investors so they have a place to put their money. All you really have to do is give the Fed wire instructions and tell them to send the money. Why do you need bonds? You want a $12 million aircraft carrier from General Dynamics or whoever makes them? Just give them the wire instructions, send the money straight from the Fed. Why do you need a bond market? Okay, Stephanie, what else you got on your mind? Well, she goes, we don't need a tax system. The idea that you have to pay for stuff is nonsense. Just send the money from the Fed. Oh, well, why do we have a tax system? Oh, we don't need it to pay for things, but we do need it to redistribute income. So now things are so far gone. Things are so radical that it used to be you said, well, we need taxes to pay for the spending. Then they said, well, no, not really. We can spend all we want. Not a problem. And then you say, well, why are you raising taxes? Well, the answer is to redistribute income. Now, they're going to say that they're raising taxes to pay for the infrastructure bill, which isn't an infrastructure bill. You see how these are all lies? The infrastructure bill is not an infrastructure bill. It's mostly social spending. And they're not raising taxes to pay for it, even though they say they are, because they say they don't need a tax system. They are raising taxes to redistribute income, take it from the rich and give it to everybody else. So it's one lie after another. But the result is spending that will not have any stimulative effect, by the way. If you want to get down to the economics, you're not going to get the stimulus. You're not going to get the growth. Taxes are a headwind to growth. Now we're getting kind of back to your earlier question about what can an investor do in this world. But it's just one lie after another.
And so what is the end game? You know what? I'm going to take a pause here and I'm going to invite you back.
Okay.
Because I think that this conversation is not going away. And the theme right. that I was looking at is like, how do these big political issues tie into your finances and stuff? So I'll be writing about this and then I'll invite you back and we'll talk about it again.
Thanks,
Ash. Oh, by the way, your contributions to the Daily Proof have been helpful for me as well, because I'm reading it at the same time I'm trying to like figure these things out. And a lot of times I'm like, oh, that's interesting. I hadn't thought of it that way.
Well, I think newsletters and books are maybe the last two channels where we can still say
and actually say things that we believe in.
Correct.
Or question.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you, Jim.
Thanks, Allison.
We'll talk to you soon.
Great.
All right. Thanks. Bye. That was Jim Rickards. Be sure to grab Jim's latest book, The New Great Depression, Winners and Losers in the Post-Pandemic World.